This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 1st, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 437. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, freelance journalist David Agrin on the aftermath of the killing of Mexican narco-terrorist El Mencho, which sparked a nationwide emergency. What it means for average Mexicans, Canadians on holiday in Puerto Vallarta, and the upcoming FIFA World Cup. David Agrin is originally from Chilliwack, BC, and his reporting from Mexico and Latin America has appeared in the Globe and Mail, Maclean's, CBC Radio, Unheard, The Guardian, and USA Today, among others. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. February 22nd, as Canadians everywhere in the world were watching their TVs or computers or smartphones as Canada was playing the United States for the men's gold medal in Olympic hockey in Milan, Italy. Well, some of those Canadians down in the Puerto Vallarta area of Mexico also got on their computers and sent back images of an unfolding situation there. Fires on the street, black smoke, cars that were commandeered by thugs. What turned out to be a major military operation in Mexico to take down a major drug dealer, one of the most wanted in Mexico. And joining me to talk about that, how Mexico got there to that day and what that means for Canada and Canadians and what that also means for the FIFA World Cup coming up, which is co-hosted by Mexico, is David Agrin. He's a journalist who is covering Mexico and Latin America. He's been in the region working on stories for multiple international media outlets since 2006. He's actually originally from Chilliwack, British Columbia, and he studied journalism at Mount Royal University in Calgary. And he's joining me right now from Buenos Aires, Argentina. Now, there's tens of thousands of Canadians in Mexico who were vacationing in Puerto Vallarta. Some of them are still stuck there or waiting for their flights out. Things are, according to reports I've seen, starting to return to normal. But they were surprised with what happened on February 22nd, on that Sunday morning. What was your reaction to this?
In a way, I guess inevitable. I think I was surprised not so much by the reaction of the drug cartel. I was surprised more that they went after El Mencho, the crime boss, the leader of the Jalisco New Generation cartel. He was public enemy number one in Mexico, had a very mendacious reputation, a man known for cruelty and violence. And his, I guess you could say, his contribution to the Mexican underworld was that he just took violence to another level. He confronted the state. His cartel shot down a government helicopter. They would attack police convoys. They would go into other states, such as the state of Michoacán. They were trying to take territory there, and they deployed littered landmines all over the place. They used drones to drop bombs. And then, you know, in Guadalajara, there's a lot of missing young people. And apparently one of the things they would do is recruit people forcibly by through call center jobs that were effectively a bait and switch. So one of the things they would do, that this cartel would do, is that whenever the military was going to go after a leader, whether El Mencho or someone, another lieutenant, is that they would deploy what are called narco bloqueos. And that's what you saw in places like Puerto Vallarta. They would commandeer vehicles and burn those vehicles. And that's basically a way to impede the authorities so that they can, if they're en route, they can't get to the target to arrest him, or they can't get out of there with the target, and there's an opportunity for a rescue. So, not a surprise that they used this tactic, but I guess the surprise is that a couple things. One is that the government went and got him. This shows a complete turnaround in the Mexican government's crime strategy and how much pressure they're under from the U.S. government. And there's been reporting since to show that basically the Mexican government decided we better get this guy, or maybe the Trump administration might do something where they send in U.S. soldiers or a drone to try and take him out. And then this reaction, it's more the scale of the reaction. 20 different states, 25 National Guard killed in the process. And the fact it happened in Puerto Vallarta, I guess, shouldn't be surprising. I know Canadians talk about being that go there will say that they're safe, and I have no doubt that they are. I don't discourage people from going, but there was a cartel, a heavy cartel presence there. And it's the way from my reporting, it's been explained to me, is there's something we call Pax Narca, narco peace. So basically they controlled the area and they kept the peace, which is why it felt so safe until it wasn't.
The $15 million reward that was offered for the arrest of El Mencho, full name Nemesio Ruben Oseguera Cervantes, the head of the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, he was killed in this operation, so he won't be brought to justice like El Chapo was famously by the Americans. How did this guy go from being just a police officer to one of the most wanted criminals in the world?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Some of these drug bosses come from very humble origins. Of course, El Chapo came from an isolated mountain village where his father was a gomero. They were basically growing poppies, opium poppies. So with El Mencho, he came out of the state of Michoacán, which is to the south. It neighbors Jalisco State. It unfolds to the west of Mexico City. It's famous, of course, for the butterfly sanctuary, and then it's the hub of the Mexican avocado industry. And he was from a zone kind of on the road going down to Estapa called Tierra Caliente, Hot Earth. And it's long been a hub of drug activity, especially marijuana growing, if you want to go back far enough. But he came out of there, went to the United States, like many people from that region did, got into trouble there, ended up getting kicked out of the country and back to Mexico, and he became a cop. And as tends to, unfortunately, happens in these places, police end up in cartels, and there was the cartel called El Cartel de Milenio, so he ended up in the ranks of that, basically providing protection, and he worked his way up. And one of the things that got the Jalisco New Generation Cartel going was that a major leader in that cartel was killed in Guadalajara and that actually in 2010. And ironically, that pretty much happened right on the eve when this stadium where the FIFA World Cup is going to happen in Guadalajara was being inaugurated. So when the Milenio cartel split apart, Jalisco New Generation was one of the splinters that emerged, and it just went about effectively through force, through violence, it started to dominate. Now it should be, I think it's a little more sophisticated than just brute force. They move a lot of drugs. Obviously, cocaine is one of the things they do. The Port of Manzanillo is always in conflict. They have fought with the Sinaloa cartel over that, and part of the reason is because that's where a lot of precursors come in from Asia for making things like meth and now fentanyl. But the thing too is that they're very their financial arm is very sophisticated. They also have a lot of, I guess, what you would call how to describe it, sort of affiliates. Mexico is a very fragmented criminal landscape. So one of the they'll have this presence in Tabasco State, which is the far on the Gulf Coast, as an example. And we know that just because there was a group, the police chief there was named in military document, military intelligence documents as being a head of a group that was an affiliate of the CNGH. So it had a big presence of its own, but it also had a lot of these affiliates which gave it such a long reach. And so through violence and criminal smarts, he got to the top of the food chain, and it should be said he was very well protected. The Mexican military says that they basically had rocket propelled grenades, to try and fight. His bodyguards had that to fight off soldiers when they went to get him.
You described this this sense of peace that the cartels seem to have a bit of a truce normally with the military and the police, which gives Canadian tourists a sense of security that they're not going to be caught in the crossfire. But some of them were seeing this right out of their windows of their hotels or from their rooftop patios. Some of them were locked down inside where their accommodation was. How is this achieved? Is it because there is corruption within the police and the military, or the police and the military afraid of the cartels, because the cartels basically operate their own private armies?
I guess with Puerto Vallarta, in some places, not all places, but a lot of places, one of the things that the whole idea of Pax Narca that happened in the past was, this is going back 20, in the last century, under institutional revolutionary party rule, is that there was a deal that the drug cartels got free reign. They could go do their business so long as they kept their violence out of populated areas. And so one of the things that happens in a lot of towns across Mexico is there's a lot of extortion. That's a big business. With Puerto Vallarta, according to surveys, there's a survey from the Mexican version of Statistics Canada. It's called the INEGI, and they have this perceptions of urban security survey. Puerto Vallarta ranked number 8, and I believe that was out of 90 urban areas in Mexico. So it was one of the top perceptions. This is a perception survey. So the perceptions of security there was that it was one of the top in Mexico. But at the same time, this is a place that's had a long history of Jalisco New Generation cartel activity. I'm told it's very much they have a lot of money laundering activity that goes on there. That's they recruit heavily out of there. That's another reason why there was such violence in there. A former governor of Jalisco State in 2020 was killed in a posh restaurant bathroom there. This guy had just left office a couple years earlier. We don't really know exactly why they targeted him, but this is a guy that once upon a time was talked about being in Mexico as a presidenciable. One of El Chapo's sons was apparently kidnapped in a restaurant there in 2016. It's not unheard of the narco activity is always there, but a lot of times it just sort of feels like when there's a peace in town, you would sort of there's just always these rumors going around. Well, the reason this town is quiet is because the drug cartel bosses, their families live here, or it's neutral territory, or this is one of the things that has to be said, is that when one criminal organization has control over what they call in Mexico a plaza, a crime territory, it tends to be calm. It tends to, just for obvious reasons. There might be some violence if the army comes after them. Just to quickly make this point, one of the things why I said, in a way, I'm a little surprised that they went after El Mencho, they went after such a big guy, and why this shows the Trump administration's pressure on Mexico, is that President Sheinbaum, Claudia Sheinbaum's predecessor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, between 2018 and 2024, he had a security policy called abrazos, no balazos, hugs, not bullets. And it was a campaign platform. It was a campaign slogan. It was brilliant. It was it rhymes, and it conveyed this idea that they were going to get to the root causes of violence, which he thought was poverty and corruption. Well, it just turned out to be basically that he gets effectively just told the army, don't go after narcos, and he would do these things. The reason he did not want to see these kinds of activities, these kinds of narco bloqueos, is that we saw on Sunday. And the reason, and so the army, the drug cartels basically had free reign to do what they wanted. And so he had the idea that maybe if that wasn't happening, these guys, if they weren't being pursued, they would behave. So I was just a little surprised. I think what's happening is that now we have basically, the government has shown that it has a new security strategy, and it's going to keep going after big cartel bosses. I don't think that now that doesn't necessarily calm the country, because whenever you get rid of a cartel boss leader, all the underlings start fighting for what's the control over a leaderless empire. And I guess one last thing, with the Canadians that go down and talk about, I don't want to alarm them. Don't be scared. Don't cancel your trips or anything. Just don't do dumb things. Don't go buy drugs, because drug dealing is a way to find trouble. And the drug cartels do fight over that, and some of the violence can be attributed to that. But again, just recognize that, you know, when you say you feel safe in Mexico and it's you're safer there than you are in Canada, that's not necessarily the case for the Mexican people. And, you know, yes, you might know some of them, but you know, my experience in Mexico is they're very friendly, but it takes a long time before they'll confide anything that sensitive to you.
How will this disrupt the cartel supply chains? You know, these cartel supply chains are quite intricate. They reach around the world. They reach especially here to Vancouver, where we've got a major international port, an airport. We're next door to the United States, a porous border. We see the impacts on our streets of fentanyl, especially.
Probably won't. I mean, I think that's just the long and the short of it, is that I think one of the things that you just, I feel like it's the kingpin strategy. Like I said, you get rid of a leader, and then the organization splinters, and that splintering it causes so much violence, because when the underlings start fighting with each other, they need money. They need put it one way, their supply chains in some ways often get disrupted. Their drug side of their business gets disrupted. And so while that's being, while that's cut and they're not making as much money, they have to find other ways to make their payrolls, cover expenses. So one of the things they do is they pick up the extortion. The extortion rackets start going a little stronger, more kidnappings, more auto theft. And so you start seeing a lot of, I guess you could sort of say freelancing that goes on. I think with these supply chains, I've always felt like what's happened in Mexico is they've just never done a really good job. And this goes even with the United States as well. They've just not targeted the money to the same degrees as they could. And there's now certain, there's some of these ways of making loans out of China that have moved that are used now for money laundering that have been, you know, reported on in various media. I think that's where it has to. I think that's where it has to happen. You know, on the ground, this supply side attempt at stopping everything is, you know, it can only go so far. It only goes so far. You know, the war on drugs has been going on for how many years, and it's just not stopped. I guess, but the only thing I would have to say though is that the drug cartels in Mexico, I think you need to look at them not simply as drug cartels, but well diversified criminal organizations that really do pose a menace to the country. They control a lot of local police forces. They've infiltrated governments. A lot of noise about state governors in cahoots with narcos. I think they harm a lot of Mexicans through extortion and kidnap and other crimes. So. They steal gasoline straight out of Pemex pipes and fence it. I think there has to be a frontal confrontation on the cartels for those reasons. But I think until the money, the financial side of it is really taken seriously, I think these supply chains just don't get disrupted.
Big question hanging over Mexico right now, since it's approaching the 100-day countdown to the FIFA World Cup, which is primarily an American-hosted tournament, but Canada and Mexico are both junior partners. There are three cities in Mexico which are host cities of matches, and one of those is Guadalajara, close to Puerto Vallarta. What are you hearing about any impacts of this security operation, of the cartels, and of the uncertainty over security affecting the tournament?
Various, you know, football federations are raising questions, understandably so. There was actually World Diving Championships to be held in Guadalajara next week. Those have been canceled. And so it sort of reminds me back 2011, when Guadalajara was the host of the Pan American Games. In the lead up to that, there was violence in the region. It just seemed like it wasn't very well organized. It seems like this time the organization is there, but the security side of it is raising a lot of questions. I think what this is doing is it's really, because the World Cup is going there, suddenly people are starting to get interested in real problems in Guadalajara, which on the surface is a lovely city, home of Mexican traditions, like, you know, the mariachi music, tequila, great climate, great spring-like climate all year round. But it is, it's got this seemly underbelly of crime. There have been so many public officials there that have been killed, assassinated over the years. Missing young people, lots of young people going missing. We possibly because of, through, you know, brute force recruitment into the Jalisco New Generation cartel, there are mass graves constantly being found. So, you know, New York Post has not to do. They went and found stories about how there were, you know, clandestine graves found near this stadium where the games are going to be played. So I think what it's doing is this is just shining a light on something that Mexico doesn't want to be publicized. And one of the things I've always felt with Mexico is that with its public security problems, you'd think this would be the top issue. This is what people would want to, you know, would vote for politicians that are tough on crime or have some sort of strategy, but they don't. You know, politicians just offer things like cash handouts and promote infrastructure problems, and you know those are popular. But it just seems like that this problem is so intractable. And what they do in the meantime is the president gets up and does a morning press conference every day and says everything's fine and crime rates are down 40% since Sheinbaum took office. Of course, the people I talk to point that disappearances are up by a pretty similar number. So it just sort of feels like with Mexico, crime has always just been a public security, a public relations issue. And I think what the World Cup is doing is it's putting a really harsh spotlight on this, and Mexico is going to have to get serious. I think they will probably be able to convince FIFA that, you know, we can do this, we can pull this off. But it's what's the right word? It's going to be kind of uncomfortable for them. Let's put it that way. I think the games happen and they happen without a problem, but you're going to see a really heavy military presence and a lot of unflattering media stories leading up to June.
Yeah, I covered the Rio 2007 Pan American Games and the Rio 2016 Olympics. And there were security operations before then targeting the favelas and the narco-terrorism that does occur within Brazil, which is nowhere near the level of Mexico. But the response basically was just to put more soldiers on more streets, being more visible with more machinery, more weapons to send the message to anyone who dared with any ill intent to not try while the world spotlight was on the host city. So that's obviously going to be a situation that will happen in Mexico where Claudia Sheinbaum, the president, will just have to bite the bullet.
She'll talk every morning. She gets every morning. There's a long press conference. If you remember the Trudeau press conferences during COVID, imagine that on steroids every day. So, that you're going to start hearing about how everything's fine, and they're going to bring out all these statistics, and they're going to have it's a form of gaslighting, but they will get through it. And then I think with Mexico, I've just come to the conclusion that things don't change. I really hate saying that. I think the one thing that I'm being told and from people with good knowledge is that actually, for better or worse, like it or not, the Trump administration is putting real pressure on Mexico, and some in Mexican security aren't entirely opposed to it because it does create some pressure to get things done and do things properly. I guess the only caution I would have is that does the Trump administration's interests, obviously heavy on security, heavy on fentanyl, does that match what Mexico needs? I think part of it is it's such a big, widespread-ish problem in Mexico. It's sort of like, where do you start? And I think with El Mencho, I think you could almost argue this is going back to an old strategy that President Felipe Calderon had back when he started this crackdown on the drug cartels in the late 2000s, was basically go after the most violent, which at that time were Losetas. So I think there might be a return to that strategy with a focus on the Jalisco New Generation cartel, and obviously State of Jalisco, you know, name of the cartel, that's where it's going to be focused.
Well, thank you again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. David Agran, who's coming to meet us from Buenos Aires, Argentina. He's a journalist who's covered Mexico, Latin America since 2006, graduate of Mount Royal University in Calgary, and grew up in Chilliwack, British Columbia.
Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, U.S. think tank calls for hellscape drone strategy for Taiwan. Center for a New American Security argued in the Hellscape Taiwan report that Taipei's current asymmetric defense approach, often described as a porcupine strategy, needs to evolve to keep pace with the growing capabilities of the People's Liberation Army. The report argued that Taiwan must be prepared to defend itself even in the early stages of a cross-Taiwan Strait conflict, when outside assistance could be delayed or contested. In ABC News Australia, dozens of synced videos capture humanity amid horror of Bondi attack. The Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and the Bondi attack began public hearings this week. During the making of the story, numerous survivors emphasized to the ABC the importance of examining the massacre, of understanding what happened and why, to ensure what happened at Bondi is never forgotten. The compilation provides a multi-camera, multi-location perspective of the actions and experiences of victims and survivors of the attack. In Kyoto News, China-linked actor sought ChatGPT aid to discredit Japan's Prime Minister Takeuchi, says OpenAI. The user asked ChatGPT to draft a plan with elements including spreading negative comments online about Takeuchi, posing as foreign residents to email complaints to lawmakers, using fake social media accounts to pressure her on cost of living issues, and accusing her of far-right leanings, according to the report released Wednesday. OpenAI said the user did so in mid-October after Takeuchi, as the head of the Liberal Democratic Party lawmakers group supporting ethnic Mongolians, sent a message criticizing Chinese repression in the Inner Mongolia Autonomous Region. At the time, she was president of the ruling LDP, but not yet prime minister. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, amazing cat saved Oregon man from a fire. Now the pet is missing. Tired from a night shift in Portland and the drive back to his house in Tillamook, Don Van Wormer slept right through the warnings of an imminent blaze until his cat, Fred, stepped in and did what the fire alarms couldn't. Tillamook fire officials said on Friday that Van Wormer's cat saved him from a devastating house fire that started around 6 a.m. Dozens of firefighters responded to the blaze but were unable to salvage Van Wormer's house, which they declared a total loss. In KUOW, Amazon is no longer Seattle's top employer, but its Bellevue headcount continues to climb. Amazon confirmed Friday it now employs about 49,000 people in its hometown, Seattle. That's down from a peak of 60,000 in 2020. University of Washington regained the title. Amazon now employs about 15,000 people in Bellevue. Since 2020, Amazon has moved out of more than 1 million square feet of office space in Seattle. Many blame the influx of high-paid tech workers for Seattle's skyrocketing housing costs. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substat.com for the stories behind these headlines. Kovrig says Canada should partner with Taiwan. Polyev says China, no substitute for USA. And ABC City Council majority defeats bid for World Cup community input in Vancouver. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. So you won't stand alone. You won't stand alone.
virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to search and rescue volunteers across British Columbia who put their lives on the line to save others. March 2nd is the 9th anniversary of Search and Rescue Volunteer Memorial Day in BC. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 1st, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 1st of March in 1910, an avalanche buried a train in Stevens Pass in Washington State, killing 96, the worst such disaster in Washington State history? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.